everyone, and welcome to the LaRouche Show. This is the weekly LaRouche Show. It's December 4th, 2004. My name is Marcia Mary Baker. I will be the host today. I'm economics co-editor of the Executive Intelligence Review News Service. And I'm very glad right off the bat to welcome live in our studio today, Jeff Steinberg. Welcome, Jeff.
Hi, Marcia. How you doing?
And Jeff is, many of you have the pleasure of having met or talked with him or heard him personally. He's the counterintelligence editor for Executive Intelligence Review, in very frequent touch with Lyndon LaRouche. And we have very special reason to have Jeff on today about a new, you could call it an initiative, but it's part of an ongoing battle of the ages that Mr. LaRouche is leading. And Jeff, I'd just like to say a couple things, and then I'll, because about the way the show's going to work today. But when I mention what, let me just mention the headline of the latest Executive Intelligence Review magazine cover story, which is you can also find on EIR online. LaRouche launches attack on Shultz's fascist Vulcans. That's a mouthful. George Shultz is the Shultz in question. And the Vulcans is part of this gang that's coagulating yet another administration. That's what they're trying to do right now, of Bush and Cheney. And Jeff can tell you in just a moment, by way of introduction, a very important thing that came to light about the nature of these Vulcans, as they're called, the George Shultz crowd, these fascists, that came through a new book out that Jeff Steinberg has just reviewed by a man named John Perkins. I want to say the name of the book, because the way the show will work today is Jeff Steinberg interviewed Mr. Perkins, the author, on November 29th. That's on Monday, earlier this week. And we're going to take the 20 minutes of that interview and play it for you in just a few seconds. But the book by Mr. Perkins is called Confessions of an Economic Hitman, How the United States Uses Globalization to Cheat Poor Countries Out of Trillions. And you're going to hear Jeff talking to this person. But Jeff, if you want to say a couple words about the nature of the kind of fluid situation we're in and what's upcoming right now, please do so. Otherwise, I want everyone that's listening in, either by telephone or if you're on the website, to know that we're going to have a full half hour with Jeff taking questions after we hear this November 29th tape. But anyway, Jeff, you talked to Lynn, and Lynn decided to take this man's observations and go with it.
That's right. It's a good demonstration of the German philosopher and economist and scientist Leibniz's notion that this is the best of all possible worlds, that this Perkins book came out at this precise moment. Basically, what happened is a friend of Marcia's and mine, colleague John Hofel, happened, I guess, to be surfing on the web and caught glimpse of an interview that was conducted by Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! With John Perkins a couple of weeks back. And that was when we first learned about the existence of this book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And immediately after we reviewed the interview and subsequent interviews and then finally got a copy of the book a few days later, it was very clear that what Perkins was describing was a phenomenon that we were not merely familiar with, but have been battling against in various fronts throughout the entire existence of the LaRouche political movement, namely the concentration of financial oligarchs, what LaRouche describes as the Anglo-Dutch liberal system. It's been around a long time. It's moved into a particularly murderous and virulent form, in fact, a self-destructive form, since August 15th, 1971, when Franklin Roosevelt's Bretton Woods system was torn to smithereens, I should add, by George Shultz. And since that time, the under the system that we now call globalization, a vast majority of the nations of this planet have been looted blind, have been lured into a debt trap set by the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the whole privately controlled central banking system of this planet. And what Perkins did usefully in his book was to identify his own role as a kind of, in his terms, economic hitman for that system. He talked about a few cases, head of state of Panama, Omar Torrijos, the head of state of Ecuador, Jaime Roldós, who were both murdered for resisting the debt trap that was being set for them by these economic hitmen working on behalf of multinational banking and raw material extraction and other financial interests. What people also often referred to as the real world government apparatus, more powerful than nation states. And so it became clear that the book had a great deal of merit, has some flaws and some weaknesses, and you'll hear in the interview in a few moments that we discussed some of the points, and it turns out, I think, that Mr. Perkins agrees more with LaRouche on those points and just simply didn't highlight them and didn't draw them out sufficiently in the book. But nevertheless, it was an extremely useful intervention. The book has become somewhat of an underground bestseller, underground in the sense that the national news media, the major establishment news media, have completely blacked out the story. But nevertheless, the book itself is in its third printing. And to buttress the intervention by Perkins, which comes at a very critical moment with the apparent, and I emphasize the word apparent, victory of George Bush in the November 2nd elections. We won't know the official outcome of the elections until the constitutional process runs out on January 6th, when a joint session of Congress convenes to either ratify or challenge the vote of the Electoral College. That vote comes up on December 13th. So there are hearings in the U.S. Congress sponsored by the Democrats that will be taking place this coming Wednesday, I believe all-day hearings, to be hosted by Congressman John Conyers, the ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, taking up the question of a massive pattern of voter suppression in the elections in Ohio. And Conyers has sent out a letter to the Ohio Secretary of State, Blackwell, urging him to come to Washington to appear voluntarily at these hearings and to explain a pattern of what probably amounts to criminal misconduct, violation of the Voting Rights Act, by leading Republicans, including elected government officials. This past week, illustrative of this, the chairman of the Bush-Cheney re-election campaign for all of New England was indicted on charges of voter suppression under the Voting Rights Act for his actions in 2002 during the election between John Sununu Jr. and Gene Shaheen for a U.S. Senate seat in New Hampshire. So this is a very live issue. And so in the midst of this political turmoil here in the United States, a crash of the dollar system, chaos in Iraq, and the potential for outbreak of major chaos in the Ukraine, encouraged by the likes of Zbigniew Brzezinski, which could trigger the endgame phase of the dollar crisis and the demise of this whole economic hitman system. Here we have the emergence of the Perkins book, perfect example of why this is the best of all possible worlds. And so we've decided to run with it, to promote the book, but to also publish in the pages of Executive Intelligence Review and in EIR Online our own far more massive documentation of the process by which the global financial oligarchy has carried out systematic genocide on a scale far beyond Hitler using techniques of debt entrapment, corruption, seizure of strategic raw materials. Some of the listeners to this broadcast are probably already familiar with Henry Kissinger's early 1970s National Security Study Memorandum 200, which proposed the depopulating of many nations around the world so that their strategic raw material wealth could be seized by the United States and our Western allies. At that time, it was justified by the Cold War. But this is a policy of mass genocide through the accountant's pen. And so for that reason, we are very much encouraging people to get a hold of this Perkins book, to read it, but particularly to read it in the context of the far more voluminous material on the larger documentation of the economic hitman phenomenon that's going to be pouring out of the pages of EIR magazine. We had the cover story that Marcia mentioned this week. I can tell you the next issue of EIR will have the transcript of the interview with John Perkins. We'll have my book review of his book. We'll feature a major piece by Helga Zepp LaRouche revisiting and reviewing the assassination of German banker Alfred Herrhausen in 1989. He was a leading collaborator of LaRouche, not directly, but by process of proceeding on parallel tracks in the pursuit of a just economic solution for Eastern Europe and Russia in the wake of the breakup of the Soviet Union. There are other elements, including a timeline covering all of the major developments on this economic hitman front from the period of the breakup of Bretton Woods in 1971, pretty much up through to the present. And we've got, I can tell you, an even more extensive package in store for the next issue. So this is going to be a running documentation, and our intention is to actually translate all of this material eventually into a book that will be a complement and a supplement to Perkins' own efforts.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Jeff. I think what we'll do now, so people know, this is the LaRouche Show weekly from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time, and we are now have, Jeff, about 30 minutes of the interview of you, Jeff Steinberg, interviewing John Perkins, the author of the newly released Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and during which time we'll take a small program break. But then we will continue on the show. Thank you for the emails coming in, and Jeff will get to those as soon as the interview's over. So let's have our producer start the interview right now. Thank you.
In my view, what you're describing is something that, in a lot of respects, is a kind of alien factor to the actual sort of historical tradition of the United States. We've done a lot of historical writing and research on the founding principles and founding fathers of the country. And they were really a sort of an anti-colonial, anti-imperial bunch. And the system that you describe in the book, which is obviously very strongly nested in the banking and corporate structures of the U.S., we've sort of historically traced back to the British East India Company and the methods and policies that came out of that whole tradition, which have, unfortunately, in the course of the 20th century, been largely morphed into the United States. I don't know if you've thought about that or looked into any of that history at all.
Well, yeah, probably haven't thought about it quite that formally, but certainly that's very accurate. What we created in this country was, I think, obviously it was a beautiful dream. It's a beautiful philosophy, and I think it's one that's very pertinent to the world now, and I'm often struck by the fact that in fact, I've been talking for a long time about the heroism of the founding fathers, how they really put their heads in a noose. They were terrorists. They were traitors. George Washington, Thomas Jefferson stood up. You know, they were traitors to their ruler, who was King George. I happened to go to National Treasure, National Treasure, the movie.
Right.
Last night, I was shocked to hear Cage say that very same thing. I mean, I've been saying it for some time. I don't know whether he's plagiarizing or or whether I'm plagiarizing. He brings up that same point, which is pretty interesting.
Great. Well, what I wanted to do in terms of sequence, and we'll start the sort of Fletcher. You're there, I guess, to start the actual interview recording. I wanted to start by asking you just generally about the response to the book. What's been the?
Yeah. Let me ask you before you record. Is this phone working okay?
It's fine on my end, Fletcher.
We have a little bit of an echoey sound. Are you on a speakerphone?
I was on a speakerphone, but now I'm off the speakerphone.
That's better.
Is it better now?
Yeah.
Is that okay?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, because I got another phone if you need me to use that.
No, this one is just fine.
Okay, great.
All right, so let's just...
I want to start with there's a response to the book.
Exactly.
Well, the response has been incredible. It's been amazing to me and also gratifying. The book hasn't received what we might call mainstream press coverage. In fact, I was supposed to be on one of the major networks a couple of weeks ago, flew to New York to be on it. 2 hours before I was supposed to be on, they polled me and said that one of the major producers had decided that the political ramifications were too dire to have me on, so they pulled me at two hours before I was supposed to appear, which was rather shocking. But despite the fact that the mainstream press hasn't covered this book, it's the response has been overwhelming. It went to number one on Amazon. It's first official week in publication. It's now in its fourth week of publication, and it's in its third printing, which I've been told is without precedent in the publishing world, especially for a book that hasn't received mainstream press. I just, at my daughter's urging, I just looked at the Confessions of an Economic Hitman under Google, and there's 54 pages, each one with a whole bunch of website connections. So there's a tremendous amount of discussion being generated, and I find that to be amazing and very gratifying, because what it tells me is that people are deeply, deeply interested in the subject. As I've crisscrossed the country in the past 4 weeks on a book tour, I keep finding people who call into radio shows or come up to me, speak up during talks that I give, or come up to me after I finish the talks and say how they've always felt that this sort of thing was going on, that there were the equivalent of economic hitmen out there. They didn't know the word. They just felt it in their hearts. But how gratifying it is for them to have someone who actually experienced that and participated in the process to come out and tell the story. So what I'm getting out of all this is that it's a story that must be told, which is why I told it after 9/11. I knew it had to be told. And in the telling of the story, it is relating to a lot of people on a very, very deep level. I think it strikes to the very chords of what it is to be an American. We grow up in this country believing in ideals that are represented by our Declaration of Independence, believing that all people have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I think the American people are a compassionate people who really believe in these principles that I just cited. And yet we know at some level that we're not carrying out that role in the world. In fact, we've betrayed those very principles which are behind us, which are our foundation. We have betrayed them, and we continue to betray them. And people are fed up with this. They really want change, but they don't know quite how to go about getting change. So the first step is for people to really talk about it. You've been doing this for a long time. Your publications and your people have been spreading this word for a long time. And now I think perhaps even more people are out there spreading it.
We're here with John Perkins, who is the author of an underground best-selling book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. John, in the book, you discuss the fact that you'd been thinking about writing such a book for a long time, but you said that after the attacks of September 11th, 2001, that sort of put you over the edge that you had to do the book. Could you explain a bit about how that worked? What was going on in your mind when you saw the planes attacking the World Trade Center and the Pentagon?
Yes, it was a pivotal moment for me, as it was for many people. I never actually saw any of that until a number of days later, because I was deep in the Amazon. I'd taken a group of people who went in to learn from the Shwa of the Amazon, people I worked with for years. And during the 90s, I devoted a great deal of my time, energy, and money to nonprofit organizations working with indigenous people, including ones in the Amazon, and taking Americans in to learn from these people. And we happened to be there on 9/11, and it's an interesting story because on September 10th, we were getting in to be with the Shwa, who are amazing warriors, people I've known since the late 60s. If you've ever seen a shrunken head or a picture of one, they did it because they're the only people in the world that do. And they were the main line of defense for the Ecuadorian army against the Peruvian army in a war that was fought in 1995 between Ecuador and Peru over oil rights. Most Americans, I don't even aware that war was fought. So on September 10th, I'm in a dugout canoe going down the river talking to my blood brother. His name is Shakaim, and he's co-author of another one of my books called Spirit of the Shwa, which was published about 3 or 4 years ago by Inner Traditions. And as we're going down the river in this dugout canoe, I'm saying to him, is the peace with Peru still holding? And he says, oh, yes, there's got no problem there. But he said, now, brother, we're planning on going to war with you. And, of course, he didn't mean me personally or the group of people I was bringing in. He was referring to our oil companies that are in a position to take over, basically, the Ecuadorian Amazon for oil. That night, this group of 16 people that I'd brought in, and I sat around in a Shwa lodge by a fire, and we talked about this, and we wondered out loud how many people in the world feel this way toward us, how many people fear us and hate us, and not us individually, but our policies. So the next morning we got up and we were having breakfast. We're way deep in the Amazon, but we have one means of communication with the outside radio, with the outside world. It's a two-way radio. And every morning we try to talk with our pilots back in the Andes because they're going to fly in a few days. And some days you can't get in touch with them because of atmospheric conditions. So every morning we try to touch base with them. On September 11th, I was on the radio with them. They were listening to a commercial station that interrupted its music and gave a blow-by-blow of what was going on in New York. So I got it over this radio in Spanish, which I then translated for our group of people. And it was incredibly powerful for us, given the fact that just the night before we'd had this discussion. And three of the people thought they might have had relatives who were killed that day. So it was an amazing time, but we all thought that this would be a shaking awake for Americans. The Shwa also said this, and a couple of days later we were up in the Andes with the Quechua, who told us about their prophecies, that this is a time when there's an opportunity for tremendous change. It's the story of the eagle and the condor, which is told in Confessions of an Economic Hitman in detail. But basically, it prophesizes that the people of the North and the people of the South will come together during these 10 years before the year 2012 and form a whole new level of consciousness. And so what we were told by the Shwa and the Quechua was that this was a sign we'd enter this period, that the people of the North, who they call the eagle people, were being tested by the people of the South. The Condor people, they saw Osama bin Laden as a test for us. I came back to the States, and very shortly after that, I went up to New York to visit Ground Zero. And as I sat there and smelled the burning flesh, which you could still smell at that time, and saw the smoke rising from that pit, I realized that I had to take a lot of responsibility, that my years as an economic hitman had led to this, and that I had to come clean on that story. It wasn't enough simply to contribute my time and money to a nonprofit and try to assuage my guilt and correct the wrongs that way. I had to tell the story. I have a 22-year-old daughter, and I owe it to her and her generation, and I owe it to all Americans, and I owe it to myself. And I realized that as I visited that site at Ground Zero, and that this story has to be told regardless of the consequences, regardless of the personal risks, regardless of you know, what issues it may raise with many, many people. It's a story that the American people must know about.
John, you speak in the book about both certain personalities, the name George Shultz comes to mind, and also certain institutions like the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, who really are sort of the architects of the policies under which you functioned as an economic hitman. And you also, of course, discussed the role of the jackals, the literal assassins who come in to deal with more extreme cases of resistance. You in the book talk at some length about the Torrijos and Roldós cases. I wonder if you've got any further thoughts on this jackal aspect, if there's other cases and other instances where you were not necessarily so personally involved, but where you saw this economic hitman and jackal system unraveling, playing out.
Yeah, you've covered a lot of territory there, Jim, from George Shultz to the jackal. I do want to say that George Shultz, I do talk about, who was, of course, president of the Bechtel Corporation and then Secretary of State under Reagan, and very much deeply involved in our attacking Panama in 1989. That's described in detail in the book, how that ties in with the whole Bechtel philosophy. But I want to emphasize that this is not a partisan issue. These things have happened under both the Democratic and Republican regimes. George Shultz is a great example under the Republican, as is Dick Cheney and Condoleezza Rice and the Bush family themselves. But let's not forget that that the Kennedy and Johnson administrations had Robert McNamara, who'd been president of Ford and then was Secretary of State under Johnson and Kennedy and then became president of the World Bank, and that there were people like Brzezinski in the Carter administration. And these things occurred also under Clinton. This is not a partisan issue. The Bush family is particularly vulnerable these days because of their very, very strong connections with the oil companies. But this is something that goes on.
We're hearing today, this is on the LaRouche Show, the interview that was done between Jeff Steinberg, our EIR counterintelligence editor, and Mr. John Perkins, the author of the new underground bestseller, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. The interview was done November 29th. What I'd like to do now, we're going to continue to the finish of the interview, is just identify a few things about our own weekly program, The LaRouche Show. Those of you listening right now know it is from 3 to 4 every week. Those of you listening on the website know its web address, which is www.larouchepub.com. That's LaRouchePub.com. And those of you listening live on the by telephone and the organizer's conference call, line up your questions. Jeff Steinberg, after the interview concludes within a few minutes, we'll have a few minutes to maybe entertain some of your questions. And during the week, I really encourage everyone to call in. I'll give you a toll-free number to Executive Intelligence Review to follow up on any of this or other topics, and you dial 1-888. That's 1-888-347-3258. That's 1-888-347-3258. And with all the emails we currently have and with the calls, the questions piling up too, this is December 4th, but on December 11th from 3 to 4 p.m., we can continue on this important track of what the nature is of what we're up against regarding the kind of economic hitman globalization scheme in the world. So without further comment, let's return to the Steinberg-Perkins interview from November 29th.
And yes, as you point out, when the economic hitmen fail, which over the past four decades, we haven't failed very often. We've managed to create a world empire, the first truly global world empire, essentially without the military. We've done it through economics, through economic hitmen.
But when we fail, as we did in Panama and Ecuador, I failed in those countries to bring Omar Torrijos and Jaime Roldos around, then the jackals, who are CIA-sanctioned assassins, step in. And they did assassinate Omar Torrijos of Panama and Jaime Roldos of Ecuador because I failed. Now, if both the jackals and the economic hitmen fail, which is not very usual these days, but we did both fail in Iraq, then the next step is that we send in our young men and women to kill and to be killed. And so this huge empire has been created largely through economic hitmen, with the backup being the jackals and the step of last resort being to bring in the military. It's been a very effective and a very subtle system, and it basically puts all the other empire builders of history, the Romans, the Persians, the Spanish conquistadores, the British, the Germans, the Dutch, it puts them all to shame. We've done a much better job of it in a much more subtle way, in such a way that many of our own citizens don't realize that we've become an empire.
Perhaps you could give a bit of a description. I know you developed this at great length in the book, but I think for the benefit of our readership and people who will be listening to this interview over the radio and the internet over the next few days, a description about what the methodology is of the economic hitmen, because clearly there is a phenomenon, a desirable phenomenon of actual economic development that promotes national sovereignty rather than stealing it. You described the idea of debt slavery. I wonder if you could sort of elaborate on what does an economic hitman do under this more sophisticated imperial system?
Right, and let me start by saying I'm all for foreign aid, real foreign aid. Billions of people are destitute in this world. 24,000 people die every day of starvation. 30,000 children die every single day of curable diseases. On September 11th, we lost 3,000 people in a very tragic event, terrible event. But that same day, over 50,000 people died of starvation and curable diseases needlessly. We need to correct that, and we can. And the book, ultimately, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, is a very hopeful one that presents alternatives, that shows how we can be the first empire in the history of the world not to collapse, not to fall, as all empires eventually do, but to turn around and offer the world a truly different system, something that's never been done before. And so this is where we stand today, I think, poised at the verge of doing that. And I think, Jeff, I got a little off the subject, and what was the question?
Well, the modus operandi, if you will, of an economic hitman.
Yes. Typically, there's many different things that we do, but I'd say the most typical one is that we identify a country that has resources that we covet. And these days, that tends to be oil, although in the case of Panama, it was a canal. It could be many different things. And the economic hitmen then work out a deal whereby the World Bank or IMF or a combination of big banking institutions offers that country a huge loan, let's say $1 billion. And one condition of the loan is that a large percentage of it, let's say 90% of it, has to come back to U.S. corporations, the ones that we've all heard of, the Bechtels, the Halliburtons, the General Electrics, et cetera. And in these countries then, get paid to build infrastructure. These companies get paid to build infrastructure in the third world country, like huge power plants, ports, highways, industrial parks, that primarily serve the very wealthy people in that third world country. And the poor people get very few benefits, if any, from this. In fact, often they're worse off after this infrastructure has been built. But their country is left holding a huge debt, which means that in the process of paying off that debt, the poor people don't get the health and care and food and other social services that they should be getting. In addition, the country is in such a position, it owes so much money, it can't possibly pay off the debt. And so when we want those resources from that country, it could be a UN vote, or it could be we want the country to send troops in support of us to Iraq, but primarily, it's resources, like oil. So when we want that country to sell us oil, we say, look, you owe us all this money, you can't pay your debts. So as an alternative, sell your oil, sell your Amazon rainforest, sell your environment with all its oil off to to our oil companies at a cheap price. And that's really the way the economic hitmen have built up this global empire. And we've done it very successfully all over the world, but mostly in countries that have resources that we covet.
I don't know if you're aware of this, but back around 1974, 1975, there was actually a formal doctrine that was promulgated. Henry Kissinger and I presume Shultz were sort of key players in this. It was called National Security Study Memorandum 200. And in that document, using the Cold War as the sort of, you know, pretext, Kissinger said that the strategic raw material wealth of the Third World is so vital to the United States and the Western Alliance's war against communism that it was a national security matter for the United States to assure the population reduction in these countries, because if these countries developed and prospered and had expanding populations and modern economies, they'd deplete these raw materials, which were urgently needed to fight communism. And there were many, many years before this document was released publicly. Now it's declassified and not exactly widely known, but known among a certain group of people. And I think that you'll probably find that there's been a certain receptivity in response to what you present in the book, because documents like this have been now percolating around, and there is a sense of exactly what you're describing in this economic hitman system.
Yes. Yes, it's amazing what goes on at the highest levels of the corporatocracy, government, big business, and big banking, that we Americans are blind to. I'm struck as I travel around the world. I just came back from India and Tibet a couple of months ago, and I travel to South America. I travel around quite a lot, and I'm always struck by how in so many other countries, even relatively illiterate people are suspicious of their governments. They believe that corruption occurs at the highest levels, and they believe that our government is corrupt, and they question things. And that's one of the reasons that they overthrow governments frequently. We call these banana republics, but in fact, some of it's done very democratically. In our country, we tend to accept things and face value what our leaders say. And I think it's very important that we stop doing that. I think it's very important that we question. That is really the basis of a democracy, is when people question their rulers. And it doesn't have to be done in a negative way. It's terrible when people who question their government are called traitors, because that's what the democratic system is all about. We need to constantly question these people. We need to constantly question the heads of the corporations, the heads of the banks, all of these people. You know, we need to look beneath the surface. The document you're referring to, the Henry Kissinger document, is a very good case in point. And you know, what's going on at the highest levels of government that we are so unaware of and need to be more aware of? We need to demand that these things are brought out into the open sooner. It's our country and our tax dollars. You know?
Exactly.
It's our right to make those demands, and now we need to start exercising that right.
Absolutely right. Final question. We were speaking before we began the interview about the antecedents of this system that you've described so eloquently in your book. I mentioned, for example, the historical roots of some of these principles of this new imperialism in the efforts of the British East India Company and some of the agencies that we actually fought the American Revolution against, but which now unfortunately seem to have sort of morphed into the American system as a kind of a takeover by its opposite. I just wonder if you had some thoughts about that, the international character of this system. Clearly the United States has become the chief enforcer, but many of these ideas are in fact very alien to the tradition on which this country was founded, which means perhaps we've got some deeper roots we can reach back to defeat this enemy.
Yeah, our roots definitely defeat this enemy. You know, we have become what we fought against in the American Revolution. We have become that to much of the world. And a lot of people living in England in the 1770s probably were very much like we are, a majority of our people are today. They weren't aware of what the British Empire was doing overseas. They were simply aware that they were living relatively comfortable compared to most other people in the world at that time. And so they carried out their jobs. We're doing the same thing. We're blind. It took people who were willing to stick their necks in the noose, the George Washingtons, the Thomas Paines and Thomas Jeffersons, and John Hancocks, and the signers of the Declaration of Independence, to show the world what the British Empire really was like and what imperialism and colonialism truly was about. Now, these people who we now look at, George Washington, you know, we see pictures of him all over the place, and he looks quite stately, and he looks like he's living a comfortable life and all, which he was at that point after the Revolution. But we have to remember that those men who signed the Declaration of Independence were terrorists. They were traitors. They were performing treason. They would have been hanged had they lost the Revolution, because they were defying their government. And now we've basically turned our own country into something not unlike the British Empire, but a lot subtler, and perhaps in that respect maybe even more dangerous, because it isn't our armies that have created this empire for the most part. It's this very subtle form. It's our taxes. It's our economic hitmen. And we need to reverse that process. My book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, is ultimately an extremely positive book. It tells the shadow side of foreign policy, but it leads up to the current time when I truly feel that this prophecy that I mentioned before of the indigenous people, we are in this time now of tremendous opportunity for change, and all empires collapse. This one will collapse too if we continue on this path. The alternative is for all of us to rise up in arms, and I don't necessarily mean it has to be done violently, physically violently, but we really need to express ourselves. We really need to bring these corporatocracy people to task. We really need to make sure that they don't get away with this anymore. You know, we've done it before. In the late 1800s, there were the robber barons. And the Democratic Party brought William Jennings Bryan to power as their nominee for president. And he ran on a ticket opposing the robber barons. He lost the election, but when Teddy Roosevelt became president about a decade later, he implemented many of those policies, including the Sherman antitrust laws. And the corporate barons were basically put aside. It happened again in the 1920s. The corporations came to power again, and actually that resulted in the crash of 29, and then the New Deal came along, another Roosevelt came along, and once again the corporations were put back under to a certain degree. They've risen up again. It's time now that we bring them to task once again, that we take responsibility, each of us. It has to come from the grassroots, and that we take this country back, and that we spread this message throughout the world, that we are who we say we are, that we believe in the American dream, and we believe in it for all of the world. And I'm not talking about one world government. I don't believe in that. But I am talking about creating a world where everybody has the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
John, I want to thank you very much for your time. I urge all of our readers and listeners to get a copy of Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
Okay, there you have it. That was an interview done November 29th by Jeff Steinberg, who's with us here in the studio of The LaRouche Show, December 4th. And the interview was with the author, John Perkins, of the newly released book, as Jeff said, The Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And on today's show, December 4th, we now have 15 more minutes with Jeff Steinberg, and we have a number of emails, we have questions live, so here's how I would like to proceed. I will ask that Jim from Minnesota be wait a few minutes While we just put to Jeff, I'd like to compress two emails that have come in. One is from Stephanie, and I'll make clear, I think she has a message to John Perkins that she commends him for speaking out like this. Maybe we can forward it to him since the interview was done November 29th, not today. But she says that it takes some guts to be able to speak out against what the economic, this whole system. And also an email, let's put to Jeff, concerning West Africa and concerning, for example, specifically the Ivory Coast, which was one of the earliest and still centers for cocoa production in the world. And the emailer says that the French economic hitmen are very much at work there. And what would you do about it? Besides the fact, as Stephanie said, aren't you in danger if you expose such a thing? You know, how do you deal with reprisals? So, Jeff, if you'll just please address that, and then we'll go to Jim from Minnesota in a minute.
Sure. Look, the thing to be clear on is that the system, the imperial system, based on this debt slavery that's so well described by John Perkins in his book, in which we're now providing an even more in-depth, I think, sort of historical account of the ins and outs of the last 33 years of this. This system is coming to an end. You can't predict date certain, but people have been closely following the accelerating crash of the U.S. dollar. And this is a dollar that is at the heart of this entire globalization system. There's no way to opt out of the dollar-based post-Bretton Woods economic system, which means that at some point in the very, very near future, almost certainly during the early months of the presidency of whoever comes into office at the next inauguration, this issue is going to be on the table. The system is bankrupt. It's coming to an end. It's going to happen through a series of violent financial shocks, with the bankruptcy of a major Chinese company, which lost $550 million in derivatives bets just last week. We may be even far closer to it than we realize, because we don't know who the counterparties were and what the overall size of these derivative contracts were. So we could be already waking up Monday morning to news that the whole system is hitting that kind of brick wall point. So the issue is, what kind of reorganization are we going to have? Is it going to be a reorganization controlled by the bosses, the top-down pyramid control of the economic hitmen, or is it going to be a return to the Rooseveltian policies of the original 1944 Bretton Woods conference, in which the principles of national sovereignty and economic development were at the forefront? The system has to be put through bankruptcy reorganization. If we can organize the heads of state of leading countries around the world to do that, then the power of the economic hitmen and their jackals and their controllers is kaput, because we'll have gone back to a system of sovereign nation states determining the direction of the world economy and pursuing what John Perkins discussed as the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which is embedded in our Constitution and needs to be the principles for the whole rest of the world. So we're at a moment where we could very well see this entire system crack up, and all of that enormous, frightening power of the economic hitmen and their top-down controllers in this Anglo-Dutch liberal financial system suddenly evaporated. We've got to be sure that the right leadership is there. We've got to be sure that the right policies are there. And this is where the role of Lyndon LaRouche in this whole effort is absolutely indispensable. So the good news is that we've got somebody prepared to step in as a commander-in-chief under these very challenging circumstances, who's thought through the things that need to be done. There are many people of good heart and governments all around the world who are ready to move. And we've obviously got a hell of a fight on our hands here in the United States if indeed the Bush administration's dubious reelection is certified by the Electoral College and by the Congress on January 6th. But as LaRouche said recently, who knows what the world is going to look like by January 6th with the Ukraine crisis, the Iraq crisis, now this Chinese derivative blowout, which we understand may have impacted on British Petroleum, one of the leading world oil companies. So it's going to be a very rocky ride, but these guys are not all powerful. They don't have the ability to snap their fingers and implement genocide on a mass scale. They're coming, their own system is coming unglued. This is a financial-based oligarchical empire. And its weakness and vulnerability is that when the financial system melts down, their power melts down with it.
Thank you, Jeff. And I'd like to turn to Minnesota now, if our producers can connect one of the questioners. I think it's Jim. Go ahead, Jim, if you're there.
Yeah, thanks, Michelle. Jeff, good show as usual. The question I had, I read some briefings about a week ago. LaRouche had like 4 points he wanted to ask Perkins or maybe to Jeff. One of the points was his motive for writing the book after 9/11. And he seems to, in the interview, say that the world is mad at the United States, ergo somebody did it, not getting into an inside-outside type operation. I was just wondering if Jeff could throw some light on that. I don't know if that's a hang-up in his Perkins's approach, or he's just naive in that particular area.
Yeah, Jim, my sense is that what John Perkins has done has been to present a pretty compelling first-person account based on his own experiences, what he knows, what he saw, and the importance of his book, number one, is the fact that it's come out at a very convenient moment in current history. And number two, that his story is a kind of first-person account of something that we've been tracking, as you well know, on a much grander scale for a much longer period of time. The issue of the EIR that'll be out next week, it'll be posted on Tuesday on the EIR online, and it'll be printed and available as of midweek in hard copy, contains a lengthy timeline of the events that have transpired since August 15th, 1971, when George Shultz and Henry Kissinger and Paul Volcker dismantled the Bretton Woods system. And you'll see that the incidents of political assassinations, destabilizations, have become more and more a sort of a standard fare. That's something that I don't think John Perkins particularly has an expertise in. I think that he was just, you know, going through a certain kind of soul-searching process, whether to write the book, whether to just sort of, you know, turn that chapter in his life behind him. And when he saw the events of 9/11, I think it was a further impetus for him that he had to do something, that the world was in very dangerous shape. So he doesn't, I believe, have the kind of in-depth knowledge and experience looking at the world of these kinds of jackal operatives that he identifies in his book, but really doesn't, you know, dwell on or develop in any great detail. And, you know, that is an area that we've been concentrated on since the very founding of EIR and the very founding even before that of the LaRouche movement. And LaRouche himself has developed a particular insight and expertise. That's why he was on the scene live on radio in Salt Lake City as the planes were crashing into the Trade Center towers on September 11th and armed with nothing more than a depth of knowledge and background and seeing the incidents. He said, this is a military-scale covert operation. This is not an act of terrorism. It's an act of irregular, asymmetric warfare. And this particular kind of attack could not have happened without the inside complicity of people in the government, in the intelligence services, either through direct involvement or through so willfully taking down our national defenses that we would render ourselves completely open and vulnerable. Now, I think, you know, and I'm here sort of putting words in John Perkins' mouth, but I suspect that in his mind, when he heard about the attacks on 9/11, he didn't have the image of Osama bin Laden. He had the image of the financial oligarchy that stands above the economic hitmen and the jackals. And I suspect that he at least concluded, without knowledge or detailed experience on the pyrotechnics of it, I suspect that he concluded that this was the handiwork of the economic hitmen system, now striking directly at the United States. So in that sense, we didn't get into a long discussion about it. I plan to try to do some follow-up interviews and discussions with him, and I'll raise that. But certainly from our vantage point, we understand this issue of the global strategic Reichstag fire dimension of this, the inside aspect of the operation of 9/11.
Thanks, Jeff. And another point of great, you've developed this point that Jim was asking about of 9/11 and what did Mr. Perkins maybe have in mind. George Soltz, certainly the overlap there with this singular figure of the last three decades being focused on, and he's behind what, Arnold Schwarzenegger? I mean, you can just see him everywhere, right? What I'd like you to do, we only have a couple more minutes on the live weekly LaRouche show on the internet part. We'll continue with the organizer's conference call. But I understand that Mr. LaRouche himself is likely going to have a webcast very soon. He's writing a paper. Could you just preview a certain kind of what his activity is in the next few days or weeks?
Sure. Well, look, first of all, we're deadly serious that we want people to go to jail for the federal felony crimes of voter suppression. The letter that Congressman John Connally and a group of other Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee sent to Blackwell, the Secretary of State of Ohio, on December 2nd, runs for 15 pages and itemizes whole categories of vote suppression that were carried out or at least allowed to happen with the complicity of Blackwell and people in the Ohio Secretary of State office. There were dirty tricks. There were people misdirected to the wrong polling places. Letters went out, fraudulent letters on the letterhead of county boards of elections to all new registered voters, predominantly in Democratic areas, telling them that their voter registration was done illegally. There were many, many things like this. And so this fight, not over a recount, because that is not going to necessarily get you anywhere, but the fight to make sure that people who ran this voter suppression are prosecuted and put in jail, that is crucial, because it robs the hoax of legitimacy and mandate from Bush and Cheney, because they got no mandate. We don't even know what really happened on November 2nd. Certainly, we don't know what happened in Ohio. So this is going to be an issue. It's going to be a burning issue between now and January 6th. And as I say, we don't know what the world's going to look like on January 6th with this Iraq mess, with the crashing dollar, with the Ukraine crisis threatening to further blow out the dollar and create major political, hopefully not military, frictions in the heart of Europe. All of these things are creating the conditions where there must be, as LaRouche describes it in a new paper that he's in the process of completing, we've got to basically convene a new Treaty of Westphalia arrangement. And in a paper that he's completing right now called The Coming Eurasian World, he talks about the rise of Asia and the fact that we've got to integrate Asian culture into this new set of arrangements, the benefit of the other, which was the concept, the principle of statecraft that ended the 30 years war in Europe.
And I guess we'll have to end today. I thank Jeff Steinberg very much for being with us. It's December 4th, the LaRouche Show. And thank you all for participating. And thank you for your report and interview of John Perkins and his new book.